Mr. Gray knelt looking at this for nearly 5 minutes, ignoring the creeping numbness in Jonesy's extremities. And why would he take care? Jonesy was just your basic rental job, drive it as hard as you want and butt out your cigarettes on the floor mat. He was trying to make sense of it. Storm? Children? Losers? Who or what was Pennywise? Most of all, where was the standpipe which Jonesy's memories had insisted was here? At last he got up, limped back to the truck, got in, and turned up the heater. In the blast of hot air, Jonesy's body began to shake. Soon enough, Mr. Gray was back at the locked door of the office, demanding an explanation. "Why do you sound so angry?" Jonesy asked mildly. But he was smiling. Could Mr. Gray sense that? "Did you expect me to help you?" "Come on, pal. I don't know the specifics, but I have a pretty good idea what the overall plan is. 20 years from now, and the whole planet is one big red-headed ball, right? No more hole in the ozone layer, but no more people either." "Don't you smart-ass me. Don't you dare." Jonesy fought back the temptation to taunt Mr. Gray into another tantrum. He didn't believe his unwelcome guest would be capable of huffing down the door between them, no matter how angry he became. But what sense was there in putting that idea to the test? And besides, Jonesy was emotionally exhausted, his nerves jumping and his mouth full of a burnt copper taste. "How can it not be here?" Mr. Gray brought one hand down on the center of the steering wheel. The horn honked. Lad, the border collie, raised his head and looked at the man behind the wheel with large, nervous eyes. "You can't lie to me. I have your memories." "Well, I did get a few, remember?" "Which ones? Tell me." "Why should I?" Jonesy asked. "What'll you do for me?" Mr. Gray fell silent. Jonesy felt him accessing various files. Then suddenly, smells began to waft into the room from under the door and through the heating and cooling vent. They were his favorite aromas. Popcorn, coffee, his mother's fish chowder. His stomach immediately began to roar. "Of course I can't promise you your mother's chowder," Mr. Gray said, "but I'll feed you. And you're hungry, aren't you? With you driving my body and pigging out on my emotions, it'd be a wonder if I wasn't," Jonesy replied. "There's a place south of here, Dysart's. According to you, it's open 24 hours a day, which is a way of saying all the time. Or are you lying about that, too?" "I never lied," Jonesy replied. "As you said, I can't. You've got the controls. You've got the memory banks. You've got everything. But what's in here? Where is there? How can there be a there?" "I don't know," Jonesy said truthfully. "How do I know you'll feed me?" "Because I have to," Mr. Gray said from his side of the door. And Jonesy realized Mr. Gray was also being truthful. If you didn't pour gas into the machine from time to time, the machine stopped running. "But if you satisfy my curiosity, I'll feed you things you'll like. If you don't..." The smells from under the door changed, became the greenly assault of odor of broccoli and Brussels sprouts. "All right," Jonesy said. "I'll tell you what I can, and you feed me pancakes and bacon at Dysart's. Breakfast, 24 hours a day, you know. Deal?" "Deal." "Open the door and we'll shake on it." Jonesy was surprised into a smile. It was Mr. Gray's first attempt at humor, and really not such a bad one. He glanced into the rearview mirror and saw an identical smile on the mouth which was no longer his. That was a little creepy. "Maybe we'll skip the handshake part," he said. "Tell me." "Yes, but a word of warning. Break a promise to me, and you'll never get to make another one. I'll keep that in mind." The truck sat at the top of Standpipe Hill, rocking slightly on its springs, its headlamps blazing out cylinders of snow-filled light, and Jonesy told Mr. Gray what he knew. It was, he thought, the perfect place for a scary story. The years of 1984 and 85 were bad ones in Derry. In the summer of 1984, three local teenagers had thrown a gay man into the canal, killing him. In the 10 months which followed, half a dozen children had been murdered, apparently by a psychotic who sometimes masqueraded as a clown. "Who is this John Wayne Gacy?" Mr. Gray asked. "Was he the one who killed the children?" "No, just someone from the Midwest who had a similar modus operandi," Jonesy said. "You don't understand many of the cross connections my mind makes, do you? Bet there aren't many poets out where you come from." Mr. Gray made no reply to this. Jonesy doubted if he knew what a poet was, or cared. "In any case," Jonesy said, "the last bad thing to happen was a kind of freak hurricane. It hit on May 31st, 1985. Over 60 people died. The standpipe blew over. It rolled down that hill and into Kansas Street." He pointed to the right of the truck, where the land sloped sharply away into the dark. "Almost 750,000 gallons of water ran down Up Mile Hill, then into downtown, which more or less collapsed. I was in college by then. The storm happened during my finals week. My dad called and told me about it, but of course I knew it was national news." Jonesy paused, thinking, looking around the office, which was no longer bare and dirty, but nicely furnished. His subconscious had added both a couch that he had at home and an Eames chair he'd seen in the Museum of Modern Art catalog, lovely but out of his financial reach, and really quite pleasant. Certainly nicer than the blizzardy world his body's usurper was currently having to deal with. Henry was in school, too. Harvard. Pete was bumming around the West Coast doing his hippie thing. Beaver was trying a junior college downstate. Majoring in hashish and video games is what he said later. Only Duddits had been here in Derry when the big storm blew through, but Jonesy discovered he didn't want to speak Duddits's name. Mr. Gray said nothing, but Jonesy got a clear sense of his impatience. Mr. Gray cared only about the standpipe and how Jonesy had fooled him. "Listen, Mr. Gray, if there was any fooling going on, you did it to yourself. I got a few of the Derry boxes, that's all, and brought them in here while you were busy killing that poor soldier. The poor soldiers came in ships from the sky and massacred all of my kind that they could find. Spare me. You guys didn't come here to welcome us into the Galactic Book Circle. Would things have been any different if we had? You can also spare me the hypotheticals," Jonesy said. "After what you did to Pete and the army guy, I could care less about having an intellectual discussion with you. We do what we have to do. That might be, but if you expect me to help you, you're mad." The dog was looking at Jonesy with even more unease, apparently not used to masters who held animated conversations with themselves. "The standpipe fell over in 1985, 16 years ago, but you stole this memory?" "Basically, yeah, although I don't think you'd have much luck with that in a court of law since the memories were mine to begin with." "What else have you stolen?" "That's for me to know and you to think about." There was a hard and ill-tempered thump at the door. Jonesy was once more reminded of the story about the three little pigs, Huff and Puff, Mr. Gray. Enjoy the dubious pleasures of rage. But Mr. Gray had apparently left the door. "Mr. Gray?" Jonesy called. "Hey, don't go away mad, okay?" Jonesy guessed that Mr. Gray might be off on another information search. The standpipe was gone, but Derry was still here. Ergo, the town's water had to be coming from somewhere. Did Jonesy know the location of that somewhere? Jonesy didn't. He had a vague memory of drinking a lot of bottled water after coming back from college for the summer, but that was all. Eventually, water had started coming out of their taps again, but what was that to a 21-year-old whose biggest concern had been getting into Mary Schratt's pants? The water came, you drank it. You didn't worry about where it came from as long as it didn't give you the heaves or the squitters. A sense of frustration from Mr. Gray? Or was that just his imagination? Jonesy most sincerely hoped not. This had been a good one, what the four of them in the days of their misspent youth would undoubtedly have called a fucking pisser. Roberta Cavell woke up from some unpleasant dream and looked to her right, half expecting to see only darkness. But the comforting blue numbers were still glowing from the clock by her bed, so the power hadn't gone out. That was pretty amazing considering the way the wind was howling. 104 a.m., the blue numbers said. Roberta turned on the bedside lamp, might as well use it while she could, and drank some water from her glass. Was it the wind that had awakened her? The bad dream? It had been bad, all right. Something about aliens with death rays and everyone running, but she didn't think that was it, either. Then the wind dropped, and she heard what had waked her. Duditz's voice from downstairs. Duditz. Singing? Was that possible? She didn't see how, considering the terrible afternoon and evening the two of them had put in. For most of the hours between 2 and 5.
Beavers dead.
Duditz, seemingly inconsolable, finally bringing on a nosebleed. She feared these. When Duditz started bleeding, it was sometimes impossible to get him stopped without taking him to the hospital. This time, she had been able to stop it by pushing cotton wads into his nostrils and then pinching his nose high up between the eyes. She had called Dr. Briscoe to ask if she could give Duditz one of his yellow Valium tablets, but Dr. Briscoe was off in Nassau, if you please. Some other doctor was on call, some white coat Johnny who had never seen Duditz in his life, and Roberta didn't even bother to call him. She just gave Duditz the Valium, painted his poor dry lips and the inside of his mouth with one of the lemon-flavored glycerin swabs that he liked. The inside of his mouth was always developing cankers and ulcers. Even with the chemo over, these persisted. And the chemo was over. The doctors, not Briscoe, not any of them, wouldn't admit it. And so the plastic catheter stayed in. But it was over. Roberta would not let them put her boy through that hell again. Once he'd taken his pill, she got into bed with him, held him, being careful of his left side where the indwelling catheter hid under a bandage, and sang to him. Not Beaver's lullaby, though. Not today. At last he had begun to quiet, and when she thought he was asleep, she had gently pulled the cotton wads from his nostrils. The second one stuck a little, and Duditz's eyes had opened, that beautiful flash of green. His eyes were his true gift, she sometimes thought, and not that other business, seeing the line and all that went with it.
Mama?
Yes, Duddy?
Ear in hand?
She felt such sorrow at that, and at the thought of Beaver's absurd leather jacket which he had loved so much and finally worn to tatters. If it had been someone else, anyone else but one of his 4 childhood friends, she would have doubted Duddy's premonition. But if Duditz said Beaver was dead, then Beaver almost certainly was.
Yes, honey, I'm sure he's in heaven. Now go to sleep.
For another long moment, those green eyes had looked into hers, and she had thought he would start crying again. Indeed, one tear, large and perfect, did roll down his stubbly cheek. It was so hard for him to shave now. Sometimes even the Norelco started little cuts that dribbled for hours. Then his eyes had closed again, and she had tiptoed out. After dark, while she was making him oatmeal, all but the blandest foods were now apt to set off vomiting, another sign that the end was nearing, the whole nightmare started again. Terrified already by the increasingly strange news coming out of the Jefferson tract, she had raced back to his room with her heart hammering. Duditz was sitting upright again, whipping his head from side to side in a child's gesture of negation. The nosebleed had restarted, and at each jerk of his head, scarlet drops flew. They spattered his pillowcase, his signed photograph of Austin Powers, Groovy Baby was written across the bottom, and the bottles on the table, mouthwash, Compazine, Percocet, the multivitamins that seemed to do absolutely no good, the tall jar of lemon swabs. This time, it was Pete, he claimed, was dead. Sweet and not terribly bright, Peter Moore. Dear God, could it be true? Any of it? All of it? The second bout of hysterical grief hadn't gone on as long, probably because Duditz was already exhausted from the first. She had gotten the nosebleed staunched again, lucky her, and had changed his bed, first helping him to his chair by the window. There he'd sat, looking out into the renewing storm, occasionally sobbing, sometimes heaving great, watery sighs that hurt her inside. Just looking at him hurt her. How thin he was, how pale he was,
how bald he was. She gave him his Red Sox hat, signed across the visor by the great Pedro Martinez. "You get so many nice things when you're dying," she sometimes mused, thinking his head would be cold there, so close to the glass. But for once, Duditz wouldn't put it on. He only held it on his lap and looked out into the dark, his eyes big and unhappy. At last, she had gotten him back into bed, where once again her son's green eyes looked up at her with all their terrible dying brilliance. "I'm sure he is." She hadn't wanted to cry, desperately hadn't wanted to. It might set him off again, but she could feel the tears brimming. Her head was pregnant with them, and the inside of her nose tasted of the sea each time she pulled in breath.
"Inhale here?"
"Yes, honey."
"I hear and be in heaven."
"Yes, you will. Of course you will. But not for a long while." His eyes had closed. Roberta had sat beside him on the bed, looking down at her hands, feeling sadder than sad, more alone than lonely. Now she hurried downstairs, and yes, it was singing all right. Because she spoke such fluent Duditz, and why not, it had been her second language for over 30 years, she translated the rolling syllables without even thinking much about them. "Scooby-dooby-doo, where are you? We got some work to do now. I've been telling you, Scooby-doo, we need a helping hand now." She went into his room not knowing what to expect, certainly not what she found. Every light blazing, Duditz fully dressed for the first time since his last, and very likely final, according to Dr. Briscoe, remission. He had put on his favorite corduroy pants, his down vest over his Grinch t-shirt, and his Red Sox hat. He was sitting in his chair by the window and looking out into the night. No frown now, no tears either. He looked out into the storm with a bright-eyed eagerness that took her back to long before the disease, which had announced itself with such stealthy, easy-to-overlook symptoms. How tired and out of breath he got after just a short game of frisbee in the backyard. How big the bruises were from even little thumps and bumps, and how slowly they faded. This was the way he used to look when... But she couldn't think. She was too flustered to think. "Duditz! Duddy, what?"
"Mama, where are your lunch?"
"Mama, where's my lunchbox?" "In the kitchen. But Duddy, it's the middle of the night. It's snowing. You aren't..." Going anywhere was the way that one ended, of course, but the words wouldn't cross her tongue. His eyes were so brilliant, so alive. Perhaps she should have been glad to see that light so strongly in his eyes, that energy, but instead, she was terrified.
"I need my lunchbox. I need my lunch."
"I need my lunchbox. I need my lunch." "No, Duditz." Trying to be firm. "You need to take off your clothes and get back into bed. That's what you need, and all you need. Here, I'll help you." But when she approached, he raised his arms and crossed them over his narrow chest, the palm of his right hand pressed against his left cheek, the palm of his left hand against the right cheek. From earliest childhood, it was all he could muster in the way of defiance. It was usually enough, and it was now. She didn't want to upset him again, perhaps start another nosebleed. But she wasn't going to put up a lunch for him in his Scooby lunchbox at 1:15 in the morning, absolutely not. She retreated to the side of his bed and sat down on it. The room was warm, but she was cold, even in her heavy flannel nightgown. Duditz slowly lowered his arms, watching her warily. "You can sit up if you want," she said. "But why? Did you have a dream, Duddy? A bad dream?" "Maybe a dream, but not a bad one. Not with that eager look on his face." And now she recognized it well enough. It was the way he had looked so often back in the 80s, in the good years before Henry, Pete, Beaver, and Jonesy had all gone their separate ways, calling less frequently and coming by to see him less frequently still, as they raced toward their grown-up lives and forgot the one who had to stay behind.
It was the look he got when his special sense told him that his friends were coming by to play. Sometimes they'd all go off together to Strawford Park or the Barrens. They weren't supposed to go there, but they did. Both she and Alfie had known that they did, and one of their trips there had gotten them all on the front page of the newspaper. Sometimes Alfie or one of their moms or dads would take them to airport mini-golf or to Fun Town in Newport. And on those days, she would always pack Duddits, sandwiches and cookies and a thermos of milk in his Scooby-Doo lunchbox. He thinks his friends are coming. It must be Henry and Jonesy he's thinking of because he says Pete and Beeve. Suddenly a terrible image came to her as she sat on Duddits's bed with her hands folded in her lap. She saw herself opening the door to a knock that came at the empty hour of 3 in the morning, not wanting to open it, but helpless to stop herself. And the dead ones were there instead of the living ones. Beaver and Pete were there, returned to the childhood in which they had been living on the day she had first met them, the day they had saved Duddy from God knew what nasty trick, and then brought him home safe. In her mind's eye, Beaver was wearing his many zippered motorcycle jacket, and Pete was wearing the crew neck sweater of which he had been so proud, the one with NASA on the left breast. She saw them cold and pale, their eyes the lusterless grape-black glaze of corpses. She saw Beaver step forward. No smile for her now, no recognition of her now. When Joe Beaver Clarendon put out his pallid starfish hands, he was all business. "We've come for Duddits, Mrs. Cavell. We're dead, and now he is too." She clasped her hands tighter as a shudder twisted through her body. Duddits didn't see. He was looking out the window again, his face eager and expectant. And very softly, he began to sing again. Mr. Gray? No answer. Jonesy stood at the door of what was now most definitely his office. Not a trace of Tracker Brothers left except for the dirt on the windows. The matter-of-fact pornography of the girl with her skirt raised had been replaced by Van Gogh's marigolds. Feeling more and more uneasy. What was the bastard looking for? "Mr. Gray, where are you?" No answer to this time either. But there was a sense of Mr. Gray returning. And he was happy. The son of a bitch was happy. Jonesy didn't like that at all. "Listen," Jonesy said. Hands still pressed to the door of his sanctuary. Forehead now pressed to it as well. "I've got a proposal for you, my friend. You're halfway human already. Why not just go native? We can coexist, I guess, and I'll show you around. Ice cream's good. Beer's even better. What do you say?" He suspected Mr. Gray was tempted, as only an essentially formless creature could be tempted when offered form, a trade right out of a fairy tale. Not tempted enough, however. There was the spin of the starter, the roar of the truck's motor. "Where are we going, chum? Always assuming we can get off Standpipe Hill, that is." No answer. Only that disquieting sense that Mr. Gray had been looking for something and found it. Jonesy hurried across to the window and looked out in time to see the truck's headlights sweep across the pillar erected to memorialize the lost. The plaque had drifted in again, which meant they must have been here a while. Slowly, carefully, now pushing its way through bumper-high drifts, the Dodge Ram started back down the hill. 20 minutes later, they were on the turnpike again, once more, headed south. Chapter 17. Heroes. Owen couldn't raise Henry by calling out loud. The man was too deep in exhausted sleep, and so he called with his mind. He found that this was easier as the virus continued to spread. It was growing on three of the fingers on his right hand now, and had all but plugged the cup of his left ear with its spongy, itching growth. He had also lost a couple of teeth, although nothing seemed to be growing in the sockets, at least not yet. Kurtz and Freddy had stayed clean, thanks to Kurtz's finely honed instincts, but the crews of the two surviving Blue Boy gunships, Owens and Joe Blakey's, were lousy with virus. Ever since talking to Henry in the shed, Owen had heard the voices of his compatriots calling to each other across a previously unsuspected void. They were covering up the infection for now, as he himself was. Lots of heavy winter clothing helped, but that wouldn't be possible for much longer, and they didn't know what to do. In that regard, Owen supposed he was lucky. He at least had a wheel to which he could put his shoulder. Standing outside the back of the shed and beyond the electrified wire, smoking another cigarette he didn't want, Owen went in search of Henry and found him working his way down a steep, brushy slope. Above him was the sound of kids playing baseball or softball. Henry was a boy, a teenager, and he was calling someone's name. Janie, Jolie, it didn't matter. He was dreaming, and Owen needed him in the real world. He had let Henry sleep as long as he could, almost an hour longer than he had really wanted to. But if they were going to get this show on the road, now was the time. Henry, he called. The teenager looked around, startled. There were other boys with him. Four of them. One peering into some kind of pipe. They were indistinct, hard to see, and Owen didn't care about them anyway. Henry was the one he wanted, and not this pimply startled version of him either. Owen wanted the man. Henry, wake up. No, she's in there. We have to get her out. I don't give a rat's ass about her, whoever she is. Wake up. No, I... It's time, Henry. Wake up. Wake up. Wake the fuck up. Henry sat up with a gasp, not sure who or where he was. That was bad, but there was worse. He didn't know when he was. Was he 18, or almost 38, or somewhere in between? He could smell grass, hear the crack of a bat on a ball, a softball bat. It had been girls playing, girls in yellow shirts. And he could still hear Pete screaming, "She's in here! Guys, I think she's in here!" Pete saw it, too. He saw the line, Henry murmured. He didn't know exactly what he was talking about. The dream was already fading, its bright images being replaced by something dark, something he had to do or try to do. He smelled hay and, more faintly, the sweet, sour aroma of pot. "Mister, can you help us?" Big Doe Eyes. Marcia, her name had been. Things coming into focus now. "Probably not," he'd answered her. Then added, "But maybe." "Wake up, Henry. It's 4:15. Time to drop up your cock and grab your socks." That voice was stronger and more immediate than the others, overwhelming them and damping them out. It was like a voice from a Walkman when the batteries were fresh and the volume was turned all the way up to 10. Owen Underhill's voice. He was Henry Devlin, and if they were going to try to do this, the time was now. Henry got up, wincing at the pain in his legs, his back, his shoulders, his neck. Where his muscles weren't screaming, the advancing virus was itching abominably. He felt 100 years old until he took his first step toward the dirty window, then decided it was more like 110. Owen saw the man's shape come into view inside the window and nodded, relieved. Henry was moving like Methuselah on a bad day, but Owen had something that would fix that, at least temporarily. He had stolen it from the brand-new infirmary, which was so busy no one had noticed him coming or going. And all the time, he had protected the front of his mind with the two blocking mantras Henry had taught him. "Ride a cock horse to Banbury Cross," and "Yes, we can, yes, we can, yes, we can, great gosh almighty." So far, they seemed to be working. He'd gotten a few strange looks, but no questions. Even the weather continued in their favor, the storm roaring on unabated. Now he could see Henry's face at the window, a pale oval blur looking out at him. "I don't know about this," Henry sent. "Man, I can hardly walk." "I can help with that. Stand clear of the window." Henry moved back with no questions. In one pocket of his parka, Owen had the small metal box, USMC stamped on the steel top, in which he kept his various IDs when he was on active duty. The box had been a present from Kurtz himself after the Santo Domingo mission last year, a fine irony. In his other pocket were three rocks, which he had picked up from beneath his own helicopter where the fall of snow was thin. He took one of them, a good-sized chunk of Maine granite, then paused, appalled, as a bright image filled his mind. Mac Cavanaugh, the fellow from Blue Boy Leader who had lost two of his fingers on the op, was sitting inside one of the semi-trailer boxes in the compound. With him was Frank Belson from Blakey's Blue Boy 3, the other gunship that had made it back to base. One of them had turned on a powerful 8-cell flashlight and set it on its base like an electric candle. Its bright glow sprayed up into the gloom. This was happening right now, not 500 feet from where Owen stood, with a rock in one hand and his steel box in the other. Cavanaugh and Belson sat side by side on the floor of the trailer. Both wore what looked like heavy red beards. Luxuriant growth had burst apart the bandages over the stumps of Cavanaugh's fingers. They had service automatics, the muzzles in their mouths. Their eyes were linked. So were their minds. Belson was counting down. 5, 4, 3. "Boys, no!" Owen cried, but got no sense they heard him. Their link was too strong, forged with the resolve of men who have made up their minds. They would be the first of Kurtz's command to do this tonight. Owen did not think they would be the last. "Owen," that was Henry. "Owen, what's..." Then he tapped into what Owen was seeing and fell silent, horrified. 2, 1. Two pistol shots, muffled by the roar of the wind and four Zimmer electrical generators. Two fans of blood and brain tissue appearing like magic over the heads of Cavanaugh and Belson in the dim light. Owen and Henry saw Belson's right foot give a final dying jump. It struck the barrel of the flashlight, and for a moment they could see Cavanaugh's and Belson's distorted, virus-speckled faces. Then, as the flashlight went rolling across the bed of the box, casting cartwheels of light on the aluminum side, the picture went dark, like the picture on a TV when the plug has been pulled. "Christ," Owen whispered. "Good Christ." Henry had appeared behind the window again. Owen motioned him back, then threw the rock. The range was short, but his first shot missed anyway, bouncing harmlessly off the weathered boards to the left of the target. He took the second, pulled in a deep, settling breath, and threw. This one shattered the glass. "Got mail for you, Henry, coming through." He tossed the steel box through the hole where the glass had been. It bounced across the shed floor. Henry picked the box up and undid the clasp. Inside were four foil-wrapped packets. "What are these?" "Pocket rockets," Owen returned. "How's your heart?" "Okay, as far as I know." "Good, because that shit makes cocaine feel like Valium. There are two in each pack. Take three, save the rest." "I don't have any water." Owen sent a clear picture. South end of a northbound horse. "Chew them, beautiful. You've got a few teeth left, don't you?" There was real anger in this, and at first Henry didn't understand it, but then, of course, he did. If there was anything he should be able to understand this early morning, it was the sudden loss of friends. The pills were white, unmarked by the name of any pharmaceutical company, and terribly bitter in his mouth as they crumbled. Even his throat tried to pucker as he swallowed. The effect was almost instantaneous. By the time he had tucked Owen's USMC box into his pants pocket, Henry's heartbeat had doubled. By the time he stepped back to the window, it had tripled. His eyes seemed to pulse from their sockets with each quick rap in his chest. This wasn't distressing, however. He actually found it quite pleasant. No more sleepiness, and his aches seemed to have flown away. "Yow," he called. "Popeye should try a few cans of this shit," and laughed. Both because speaking now seemed so odd, archaic almost, and because he felt so fine. "Keep it down, what do you say?" "Okay, okay."
Even his thoughts seemed to have acquired a new crystalline force, and Henry didn't think this was just his imagination. Although the light behind the old feed shed was a little less than in the rest of the compound, it was still strong enough for him to see Owen wince and raise a hand to the side of his head as if someone had shouted directly into his ear. "Sorry," he sent. "It's all right, it's just that you're so strong you must be covered with that shit." "Actually, I'm not," Henry returned. A wink of his dream came back to him. The four of them on that grassy slope. No, the five of them, because Duddits had been there too. "Henry, do you remember where I said I'd be?" "Southwest corner of the compound, all the way across from the barn on the diagonal. But no buts, that's where I'll be. If you want to ride out of here, it's where you better be too. It's..." A pause as Owen checked his watch. If it was still working, it must be the kind you wind up, Henry thought. 2 minutes to 4. I'll give you half an hour. Then, if the folks in the barn haven't started to move, I'm going to short the fence. Half an hour may not be long enough, Henry protested. Although he was standing still, looking out at Owen's form in the blowing snow, he was breathing fast like a man in a race. His heart felt as if it was in a race. "It'll have to be," Owen sent. "The fence is alarmed. There'll be sirens, even more lights, a general alert. I'll give you 5 minutes after the shit starts hitting the fan. That's a 300 count. And if you haven't shown up, I'm on my merry way. You'll never find Jonesy without me. That doesn't mean I have to stay here and die with you, Henry." Patient, as if talking to a small child. "If you don't make it to where I am in 5 minutes, there'll be no chance for either of us anyway. Those two men who just committed suicide, they're not the only ones who are fucked up." "I know." Henry caught a brief mental glimpse of a yellow school bus with Millinocket School Department printed on the side. Looking out the windows were 20 of grinning skulls. They were Owen Underhill's mates, Henry realized, the ones he'd arrived with yesterday morning, men who were now either dying or already dead. "Never mind them," Owen replied. "It's Kurtz's ground support we have to worry about now, especially the Imperial Valleys. If they exist, you better believe they'll follow orders and that they're well-trained. And training wins out over confusion every time. That's what training is for. If you stick around, they'll roast you and toast you. 5 minutes is what you have once the alarms go, a 300 count. Owen's logic was hard to like and impossible to refute. "All right," Henry said. 5 minutes. "You have no business doing this in the first place," Owen told him. The thought came to Henry encrusted with a complex filigree of emotion. Frustration, guilt, the inevitable fear. In Owen Underhill's case, not of dying, but of failure. "If what you say is true, everything depends on whether or not we get out of here clean. For you to maybe put the entire world at risk because of a few hundred schmoes in a barn, it's not the way your boss would do it, right?" Owen reacted with surprise. No words, but a kind of comic book exclamation point in Henry's mind. Then, even over the ceaseless howl and hoot of the wind, he heard Owen laugh. "You got me there, beautiful. Anyway, I'll get them moving. I'm a motivational master. I know you'll try." Henry couldn't see Owen's face, but felt him smiling. Then Owen spoke aloud. "And after that, tell me again." "Why?" "Maybe because soldiers need motivation too, especially when they're derailing. And belay the telepathy. I want you to say it out loud. I want to hear the word." Henry looked at the man shivering on the other side of the fence and said, "After that, we're going to be heroes. Not because we want to, but because there are no other options." Out in the snow and the wind, Owen was nodding. Nodding. And still smiling. "Why not?" he said. "Just why the fuck not?" In his mind, glimmering, Henry saw the image of a little boy with a plate raised over his head. What the man wanted was for the little boy to put the plate back, that plate that had haunted him so over the years and would forever stay broken. Dreamless since childhood, and thus unsane, Kurtz woke as he always did. At one moment,
nowhere at the next completely awake and cognizant of his surroundings. Alive, hallelujah, oh yes, still in the big time. He turned his head and looked at the clock, but the goddamn thing had gone off again in spite of its fancy anti-magnetic casing, flashing 12, 12, 12, like a stutterer caught out on one word. He turned on the lamp beside the bed and picked up the pocket watch on the bed table. 4:08. Kurtz put it down again, swung his bare feet out onto the floor, and stood up. The first thing he became aware of was the wind, still howling like a woe dog. The second was that the faraway mutter of voices in his head had disappeared entirely. The telepathy was gone, and Kurtz was glad. It had offended him in an elemental, deep-down way, as certain sexual practices offended him. The idea that someone might be able to come into his very head, to be able to visit the upper levels of his mind, that had been horrible. The Gray Boys deserved to be wiped out for that alone, for bringing that disgustingly peculiar gift. Thank God it had proved ephemeral. Kurtz shucked his gray workout shorts and stood naked in front of the mirror on the bedroom door, letting his eyes go up from his feet, where the first snarls of purple veins were beginning to show, to the crown of his head, where his graying hair stood up in a sleek tousle. He was 60, but not looking too bad. Those busted veins on the sides of his feet were the worst of it. Had a hell of a good crank on him, too, although he had never made much use of it. Women were, for the most part, vile creatures incapable of loyalty. They drained a man. In his secret, unsane heart, where even his madness was starched and pressed and fundamentally not very interesting, Kurtz believed all sex was foobar. Even when it was done for procreation, the result was usually a brain-equipped tumor not much different from the shit weasels. From the crown of his head, Kurtz let his eyes descend again, slowly, looking for the least patch of red, the tiniest roseola blush. There was nothing. He turned around, looked at as much as he could see by craning back over his shoulder, and still saw nothing. He spread his buttocks, probed between them, slid a finger two knuckles deep into his anus, and felt nothing but flesh. "I'm clean," he said in a low voice as he washed his hands briskly in the Winnebago's little bathroom. "Clean as a whistle." He stepped into his shorts again, then sat on his rack to slip into his socks. "Clean, praise God, clean, a good word. Clean." The unpleasant feel of the telepathy, like sweaty skin pressed against sweaty skin, was gone. He wasn't supporting a single strand of Ripley. He had even checked his tongue and gums. So what had awakened him? Why were there alarm bells clanging in his head? Because telepathy wasn't the only form of extrasensory perception. Because long before the Gray Boys knew there was such a place as Earth tucked away in this dusty and seldom visited carol of the great interstellar library, there had been a little thing called instinct, the specialty of uniform-wearing homo sapes such as himself. "The hunch," Kurtz said. "The good old, all-American hunchola." He put on his pants. Then, still bare-chested, he picked up the walkie which lay on the bedside table beside the pocket watch. 4:16 now, and how the time seemed to be rushing, like a brakeless car plunging down a hill toward a busy intersection. The walkie was a special digital job, encrypted and supposedly unjammable. But one look at his supposedly impervious digital clock made him realize none of the gear was on anything. He clicked the send squeal button twice. Freddie Johnson came back quickly and not sounding too sleepy. Oh, but now that crunch time was here, how Kurtz, who had been born Robert Kuntz, name, what's in a name, longed for Underhill. "Owen, Owen," he thought, "why did you have to skid just when I needed you the most, son?" "Boss, I'm moving Imperial Valley up to 6. That's Imperial Valley at 0600. Come back and acknowledge me." He had to listen to why it was impossible, crap Owen would not have spouted in his weakest dream. He gave Freddy roughly 40 seconds to vent before saying, "Close your clam, you son of a bitch!"